I'm going to put the needle down on this 45. From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. I'm playing this song, Love Goes to Building on Fire. It's the very first single by Talking Heads in 1977.
My love stands next to your love. I can't compare love when it's not love.
And there's a new book called Love Goes to Buildings on Fire, 5 years in New York that changed music forever. It's a fascinating book that covers not only the punk and new rock music of the day, but it looks at that period in New York City between 1973 through the end of 1977, a time when hip-hop was being birthed, salsa was finding its voice, the avant-garde scene was being heard, and the new jazz loft scene was being born. Will Hermes is a young teen in New York City in those days, a time not often revered musically as the late 70s are. So I wondered what it was that made him want to write a book about these years.
Well, it was really being interested in this era for a number of reasons. I was growing up in New York during these years. And it always seemed to me growing up that with older brothers and sisters that I'd missed this great party, this incredible renaissance that was the 1960s. And myself and my peers always felt like, gosh, you know, it's like we got kind of left with the backwash of the 70s and there wasn't that much happening. And then towards the end of the 70s, as the conventional narrative goes, music was, it was dull during the 70s and then it was saved by punk rock and hip hop by the end of the 70s. But so much of the music that I really loved and that really blew my mind was either made or kind of conceptualized during this middle period that was supposedly dead. And the more I listened and read, it seemed that it was just an incredibly rich, inventive time in musics across the genre spectrum. And it was also all happening during one of the worst times financially and civically in New York City's modern history.
So we talk about some of this music, and we brought the Talking Heads, which was a record that came out, you know, again, like you say, toward the end of the 70s, 77. Take us to around 73, the beginning of your tale, and let's talk about one of the scenes in New York. Play me something that you feel was the birth of a scene.
Well, if you had to put your finger on a piece of music that was the birth of hip-hop, which didn't really begin with people creating their own records, but began with people repurposing other records and very often incredibly obscure records, you would have to begin with this song by a group that really did not have much fame until many years after they ceased to exist, the Incredible Bongo Band, and a song called Apache, which has a very interesting history.
And I think of this as totally a novelty record. Let's play it and let's talk about its importance in a minute. So this is a record that now, for someone listening to music, knows this record.
What? From a million hip-hop records.
That's
it's
right.
It's been sampled by everyone from Nas to you name it. It's a classic. In fact, people have called it the national anthem of hip-hop. It just so epitomizes the breakbeat aesthetic, which is basically rhythmic passages that have been taken from records and repurposed for initially for dancers. And what Kool Herc did, who was recognized really as the first hip-hop DJ, he threw a party in the rec room of his apartment building up in the Bronx, 1520 Sedgwick Avenue, which tour buses now go to this apartment building to see this rec room. And he found the records that had these rhythmic passages that people really liked to dance to. And he initially would just play one rhythmic passage from one record and then cut immediately to the rhythmic passage on another record and kind of link them all together. He called it the merry-go-round.
And that's what's going on here in this song.
Well, on this song has these fantastic percussion breaks that you could isolate, and eventually it evolved to the point where you would have the same record on two turntables, and you could take like this percussion bit that we're listening to right now, and you could extend it indefinitely.
By starting the next record on your next record player at the beginning of where that break had started.
Exactly.
Right? So it's about to end on one turntable.
Ends on one record, you started it on the next record.
Total. And I love that kind of genius, by the way.
Right. Completely using the tools.
That's what great art does, right?
Yeah, to do something that had never been done. And rap evolved sort of over that, because now you had these, you know, wild percussion segments that dancers could go off on, and the DJs would be standing around and they'd start talking over the mic, maybe rhyming a little bit, and it sort of went from there.
And when you listen to this record back then when it came out, it was familiar in and of itself because it had melodies from, well, here it comes, right? This is an old melody, right?
This song was originally, I think,
it's like the late 50s, right?
Yeah, it was a surf tune. It was done by the Ventures. Bruce Springsteen even played this song during the early years of his career, just as an instrumental vamp between other songs. So it's a melting pot record because it's funk. It also has Latin percussion, which is played by a guy named King Arison, who was a Caribbean guy who played on a lot of the later Motown records once they moved out to L.A. and was originally a jazz player. So you have this jazz player who also, you know, has Caribbean roots playing on this funk record, which is actually performed by a bunch of Los Angeles film soundtrack musicians. And one of the people in the group was Jim Gordon, who was in Derek and the Dominoes, maybe the most famous rock drummer of the period. So it really brings, it's a record that brings everything together.
I love the fact that there's so many things in this book. It's really, I don't read a lot of rock books, I have to say. This one is just killing me in a good way, because all of these people whose music I know, you find them at each other's concerts. You mentioned, you know, the connection here in Apache, where not only these people in the Upper Bronx, 190 blocks uptown, are into, but somebody from Jersey who comes to play New York a lot, Bruce Springsteen, plays, and you'd find Patti Smith coming to a Springsteen concert and
Springsteen going to a Patti Smith concert. She would perform, and there would be, you know, Andy Warhol would be in the audience. You would have the guys in the Ramones would be there. The guys in Television were being there. She was very, very close with Tom Verlaine, the guitarist of the group Television.
And then the avant scene, you know, you tie that in, right?
Sure. Well, you have a famous incident was the Talking Heads played at kind of an avant-garde art space called the Kitchen Center. And Philip Glass came to the show, and he said, wow, I really like you guys. You should come to this thing that I'm working on. It's a kind of an opera called Einstein on the Beach, and you should come check that out. And so the Talking Heads went up to see Einstein on the Beach, and David Byrne was blown away. And in years to come, he would actually work with Philip Glass. David Byrne is a kind of incredible figure because he wound up working with almost every genre of music I write about here. Not jazz, but he collaborated with Philip Glass. He did a salsa record, for goodness sake, right. Ray Momo.
And you mentioned The Kitchen, which was a place where there was a fellow named Arthur Russell. Let me play this by Arthur Russell. It's called Kiss Me Again. The group he was under the name of was called Dinosaur. Let's talk about Arthur Russell. Now he's a character that...
What a character.
That at the time, I think, there are very few people who would have known who he was. But you hear this, and even though it's a very naked record in many ways, not highly produced, there's a lot going on here that was sort of really important.
Yeah, he came to New York as a composer. He played cello, and he was working in kind of avant-garde classical circles. But he was also very interested in pop music. He liked the idea of music for a wide audience as much as he was also interested in unusual stuff. And so he started a rock band, and he actually became friendly with the Talking Heads and even played cello on an early version of Psycho Killer, which didn't wind up on the album, but I think has sort of surfaced since. But his real transformation happened when he went to a disco, an early disco, The Gallery, which was kind of operated and presided over by a guy named Nicky Ciano.
And not something you would probably call a disco at that point, right? We're talking...
Right. This was a dance club, what we think of now as the modern club, which is really kind of a centerpiece of pop music culture at this point in time, really hadn't been invented. Nicky Ciano rented this space and with his brother and decided, hey, let's make this a completely immersive experience. Let's not just play records, but we can play records and we can change the mix of them. We can use equalizers to drop off all the high end and then crash it back in at kind of particular points in the song. Do the same with the bass. Let's have like lights that go on and off and mirrored globes and all that sort of stuff. It was really kind of invented in New York during this period. It didn't exist prior to that.
One of the reasons they were able to do this and open this club and so forth is it was so sort of all dilapidated back in New York City back in those days. The rent was cheap.
Yes, it was incredibly cheap. Like he was able to basically pay the rent from having one weekend's worth of parties. And Arthur Russell, the classical composer, came to hear this music, and it was incredibly repetitive and hypnotic, very much like the four-hour-long pieces that he was kind of conceptualizing in the art world. And a light bulb went off. He was like, this is kind of part of the same thing. And he was constantly working across genres and never really got recognized because it was always a little bit too weird for the dance music crowd and a little bit too pop for the art music crowd. Nobody quite knew what to make of him. But now I think people are coming to his old recordings. They've been reissued and people get it because it kind of makes sense in the context of everything that's come since.
And those four-hour pieces that you mentioned, I also think of some of the work that was going on in different parts of town, which is some of the music that was inspired by the Lamont Youngs and the John Cages of the world,
right,
and that Terry Riley's of the world. And Terry Riley's a West Coast fellow, but...
Right, but he came to the East Coast, as did Lamont Young. Both of those guys started out in California and spent time in New York and sowed some pretty fertile seeds.
Why did they matter?
Well, what they were doing, exploring kind of drone music and repetitive music of kind of real extreme duration and electrified music, really struck a chord with people making rock music. And in fact, John Cale, who worked with Lamont Young making kind of electronic drone music for a number of years in the 60s, left that ensemble to start the Velvet Underground with Lou Reed. And those ideas meshed really well with rock and roll.
And someone like Cale figures so important in the early records that Patti Smith would make, Horses.
Right. He produced Horses. And he was a god after he left the Velvet Underground. Anybody making rock and roll in New York looked to Lou Reed and John Cale as the guys who really started it all. And then, of course, Philip Glass and Steve Reich, who are probably, maybe arguably, the two most important American composers working right now, both came out of that New York scene, both profoundly influenced by what Lamont Young was doing, but kind of took their own sort of angle on a minimalist composition.
Let's play something. Let's play, should we do Steve Reich?
Sure. Let's do Steve Reich, one of my Desert Island Discs. It would be in the top five, music for 18 musicians.
I'll just plop it in about 20 minutes into a 50-some-odd minute piece here.
Exactly.
You hear this music now, and it's so, that whole idea of repetition, which happened so much at the beginning of disco music, was so important
right.
to hip-hop music, was so important to rock music and sampling, and was such a, although it tapped into the aesthetic of drone that was part of both what people might call hippie music or
right.
prog rock music.
Yeah,
it really did
music.
Launch and psychedelic music. It really did start something very different, and it branched into so many different forms of music.
Right, electronic music, drawing equally
yeah.
from disco, hip hop, and minimalist composition. Now, I think really those three strands inform what we know of as, you know, electronic music, whether it's experimental ambient sort of stuff or what we hear on the radio now. I mean, you listen to Keisha or Lady Gaga, and this is, you know, basically techno in another guise. It's part of the fabric of what music is, the timbres and the sounds that we just accept are normal, and repetition is not unusual. This was pretty strange music.
That's right.
At the time, but now it's a, you know, it's a soundtrack to pharmaceutical commercials. which is maybe appropriate.
Let's hear just a little more. sax could be a synth now, you know. It could be, really is. It's like, it's almost, I'll never meet Steve Reich probably, so I'll just say this, but it almost feels quaint. You know, I mean, it was revolutionary music that at this point is so not amped up, you know, but it had its own revolution inside of it, because it really challenged you as a listener, and I think that was
right.
What was important about this.
You kind of get, you kind of get lulled into the repetition of it, and then there's a subtle change, but because your body and ears have kind of adapted to this sort of almost drone-like steady pulse, that slight change just can feel very emotional, really profound. Mm-hmm. Certainly people who have, you know, been at a disco and kind of given themselves up to dance music in that way knows that, you know, a subtle change in rhythm or key can just, you know, have a very strange emotional power.
I think one of the things that happens a lot in New York City at that time especially was that it was the destination place if you were a musician. If you were living, as I knew, in Washington, and you were a musician, and you really wanted to make it, you went to New York. And that was true all over the country, because that's where people heard you. Now you can be heard anywhere you live.
Right.
But we take that for granted. But there were really just a handful of cities where if you went, you would be noticed, and you would then get a record contract. You'd get heard by lots of people. You'd be able to go to clubs and play your music because people would know you. And so you had a group like the Art Ensemble of Chicago,
right,
who would come to New York to be part of a scene.
Right, which they did in the mid-70s during the really full flowering of the loft scene.
Again, made possible by cheap rents, right? I mean, this is
right.
such a theme.
Where you would have people, you know, able to move into a loft space, live there, but there was so much room that they could actually have performances in their home.
One of the things that I think happened because the Art Ensemble of Chicago, I know for my own self, came down to Washington and played in the late 70s in rock clubs. There were these loft concerts that would wind up being attended by people in all sorts of different music scenes. I think this music that they played, let me just start to sneak some of this Art Ensemble of Chicago into the mix here. It had an aesthetic that I think appealed to a punk aesthetic. There was an outrage and a chaos inside of that music, I think, that was appealing.
Absolutely.
And let's just listen to a bunch of this. You come back and talk a little about who the Art Ensemble of Chicago were. This is very much music in your face.
Yeah, it's coming in part out of the free jazz movement of the early 60s, latter period Coltrane and Albert Eiler, but it also drew in all sorts of vernaculars, not just of jazz, but also of pop music. Songs did not have to be a particular structure. They did not have to end after 10 minutes. You had performance spaces that were run and controlled by the artists. So you didn't need to end a song after 9 minutes so people could order drinks at the bar, which was very often the
Never thought about that. The
mandate in jazz clubs, because, you know, you got to get people, buy some drinks, and then get them out and bring in the next round for the second set. So very much the spaces themselves shaped the music.
And one of the spaces that shaped music so much in those times is the one probably most popular and known to everybody, which was CBGB's.
Yeah.
A club in a very, very dark part of that city. I thought it was scary.
It was a little creepy. The first time I went there, the first time I went to a club show, it was to see the group Television at CBGB's. And coming in from the outer boroughs of Queens, I thought, well, you know, I'm underage. But if I dress up, maybe they'll think I'm older
Did you wear a nice shirt and jacket?
I did. I wore a nice shirt and a sweater. It might have been a cream-colored sweater. I mean, I think about it and I cringe and glad there's no evidence.
So you go there. Do you go to this club dressed up and walk past a number of people laying in the gutters, I'm sure, because that's just what was there.
Right, and then taking the train home at night, incredibly scary, very long train ride back to Queens. But, of course, the woman at the door at CBGB's took one look at me and was like, $5. And I gave her $5, and she could have cared less about asking for my ID. But it was an incredible space. It was one of the only rooms at the time it opened up, which was late 74, that rock musicians could play original material in. Can't conceive of the fact that there would not be a club that would say, hey, you're a band making new music, come on in and play. It didn't exist. You had to be a cover band playing.
Thank you for telling this
top
story.
10 hits.
This is so important. This is
otherwise you couldn't. They wouldn't hire you. And Hilly Kristal, figuring he had this dump of a bar like on the Bowery, which was patronized by a few Hells Angels from the Hells Angels center around the corner and a bunch of winos. It was like, hey, if you can get a bunch of people in here, your friends, to buy some beers, and I like the music, you're in. And he liked the Ramones. He liked Television. And one of the things I should add, there are early videos on the website lovegoestobuildingsonfire.com that I put together this book that show these bands as really kind of bad when they started out.
Yes.
They just were not good, but they had a place where they could get better and perform for their friends and Woodshed, and they became great.
And this is what you could hear in this song, Little Johnny Jewel, one of the early Television singles. Not great guitar playing, but they had something. They really had something. Let's listen a little bit. I can't turn this down, Will.
I like this.
Yeah.
Scratching.
Yeah.
And you wake up dreaming.
Yeah, it's coming. The sad part about this is that right about here is where the record would fade out and you'd have to flip it over on the 45, right?
Right. People think about punk rock as short pop songs, but this is incredibly long. It was Television's first single, and Tom Verlaine was very into the idea of releasing an 8 or 9 minute song spread out over two sides of a 45. The rest of the band, not so much. Didn't seem like the most commercial move in the world. But they were they were after something else, and it really shows, I think, kind of the transition. These guys had one foot in the 60s, one foot in extended jams of the Grateful Dead, for instance. Tom Verlaine was a huge fan of Dark Star. He wasn't necessarily a big fan of the Dead, but he heard Dark Star once in a bookstore, as he told the story, and he was like, wow, there's something here. And one foot in the sort of new kind of edgier music that they were inventing.
And over and over in this book, I mean, I think Phil Lesh of the Grateful Dead is friends with who, Steve Reich, was it?
Right. They played in an ensemble. Phil Lesh played in Steve Reich's ensemble for the years that Steve Reich was working on the West Coast. And eventually, Phil left Steve Reich's experimental music ensemble, which is based around Mills College, and joined this band called The Warlocks, who then became The Grateful Dead. And Steve Reich was not really a hippie. He wasn't feeling the Summer of Love scene, so he was like, ah, I'll get back to New York and, you know, make music with my own people. And so he did.
And then you tell stories about, I was saying how you had to flip the single over. You tell the story about the birth of the first 12-inch for dance music uptown, accidentally, right?
Right. Fascinating story in and of itself. So much that is really in every genre of music that I write about here. What happened in New York during these 5 years really determined what that music is today, whether it's dance music, whether it's modern composition, whether it's jazz. The loft era is being rediscovered by a lot of young musicians, whether it's salsa or certainly rock and roll.
And we didn't even touch so much of that. It's a fascinating read. I highly recommend reading this book. There's, you know, there's the stories that are told make this history of this music come alive. It's not just tying the threads, but you really learn who these people were, how accidental so much of this was, how seemingly just innocent so much of it was, and how important it wound up becoming, and how it affects the music we listen to now.
They were kids, you know. They were all people in their 20s and 30s. They were, you know, inventing themselves as artists, and, you know, they wound up inventing modern music in the process.
Thank you, Will Hermes.
Thank you, Bob.
Love Goes to Buildings on Fire, 5 years in New York that changed music forever. Will Hermes, of course, is music critic for NPR and All Things Considered, has been on this show many, many times. We've worked together for a lot of years. He does great writing for Rolling Stone. Who else are you writing for these days?
That pretty much covers the waterfront. New York Times occasionally, because it's my hometown paper.
Yeah, great. Thanks so much.
Love goes to y'all.
Sweet. Let's see what little Johnny Jewel and Mr. Tom Verlaine's up to here. Take care.
Take care.
Is wink your eye.